Right, welcome everyone to another Glasshouse podcast episode. We are back, and we are back now in person. Habib has moved to London, and we decided, you know, the pandemic, it's nearing the end. Let's have a look at some studios and put up some cameras so everyone can see our faces. And I think the best person we could have had as a guest for this podcast, Hash Saeed. Great to meet you, Hash.
Excited to be here.
Nice.
It's great to have you too. Just before we start, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So, born in London, I grew up here. I've also lived in the Netherlands for nearly 15 years. I've got strong cultural roots to Pakistan, hence all the Bollywood dancing that everyone sees on the gram and on YouTube. I studied politics, philosophy, economics at the University of York, just quite curious about the world, but I think I was more entrepreneurial than academic. And I found my calling almost through a consultancy that I started to help students get real-world employability opportunities at York Community Consulting. I also played a lot of hockey when I was at York, and it's great that we all share that. I think from there I was kind of, I didn't know what to do with my life. Like, you know, once you graduate, I knew I wanted to go into work, get experience. So I thought I first wanted to be an investment banker. So I did a fixed income sales internship at JP Morgan. Realized I love sales. I just don't care about bonds. Sorry to anybody that does. Yeah. So then I went down the tech route and I joined Facebook first there for their EMEA headquarters in Dublin. Had a fantastic time. I then moved into Microsoft, a role there, and then I'm now at Google. And it's all been across sort of working with VCs, startups, large clients, products, sales, growth, marketing. And yeah, literally very excited about life and being involved in a startup on the side as well, and just buzzing to be alive really at this point.
Nice. I think there's quite a lot of topics and many things you've kind of touched into. Yeah. But it's especially since we've just come out of university and everything, Habib just moved into London. There's definitely a lot of things. One thing we like to do with any new guest, I guess, on the podcast is for everyone to get to know you better, two truths and one lie. Do you have any prepared?
Two truths and one lie. It's almost like a dating question. So I think for me, okay, so two truths and a lie. So I've had to take my top off and flex to get my credit card back at a live bingo dance hall.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
I burped in a meeting. And I fought off two muggers at 2 a.m.
Huh. Okay. The meeting. What was the meeting about? And why is it such a significant memory that you burped in the meeting?
I burped in the meeting because it was with a very senior, large one of our largest clients when I was at Microsoft and with their CMO. Uh-huh. And it just kind of happened.
Did you face consequences for it, or was it just a bit like...
I thought it was legendary, to be honest. No. Played it really well.
In person, over Zoom?
In person.
In person.
Right after the COVID sort of a combo.
In person, right.
And the muggers. Just tell us about that situation.
The muggers, so the muggers was coming back from sort of Olympic hockey game, just like watching that over in Stratford Olympic Park. Tubes were shut, didn't have my phone. Mm-hmm. I took a bus, like a diversion, ended up in Whitechapel. It was like 2 a.m., no idea what's going on. Walking down a dark street, I saw two people like starting to follow me. And like me being me, I was like, right, this is quite exciting.
This is the moment I've been waiting for.
The superhero moment,
I slow down, tie my shoelace, look behind me, and I'm like, yeah, they're definitely following me. Turn streets, they're still following me. And then I'm like, do you know what? This is the moment. Turn around, go straight into them. Okay. We bump shoulders, they throw me against the wall. Oh. They start chatting and saying some stuff, and I think I said something that was apparently funny, but I'm not really a hilarious person. Right. And like from there, I think it escalated super quickly. One of them like hit me and then I just slapped him across his face, pushed the other one back and then just ran for it.
So, I mean, I'm from Stratford and that's believable, to be honest. That sounds like a day in the life in Stratford. Okay, I think we've got
the first one is...
What was the first one?
First one is, so we went to a sort of a bingo kind of hall, like a dance bingo hall. So
where was the bingo?
This was in Dublin. So
Dublin,
like 2019, dance bingo hall, basically. So everybody gets bingo cards, a lot of music playing, like cool lights, etc. And I went to the bar and I gave my card, right? Mm-hmm. And somebody, it was a Revolut card. And then the bartender gave me a Revolut card back and I bought like, you know, a lot of different stuff on it.
Right.
Went back, sat back down. And then I'm like, wait, this is not my card. So I'm like, where's my card? Then the guy on the stage is saying, could Hashim Saeed please come on stage? We have your Revolut like credit card, debit card. And I'm like, great. So then I walk up, I go to the stage and he's like, come on. I'm like, and there's like, I think 200 people here. Obviously, we've never met them. And he says to me, do you want your card? I was like, yeah, please. Like, you have to strip. He's like, you know what, you gym, you have to strip. So I say, and then they start playing like, I don't know, it was like I'm the Man or something, but Allo Black. So then I just like take my top off, oh my do a little Ted. So then he gives my card back. And then, yeah, went back, sat back down, had a really good time with my friends.
Okay, well.
Yeah. All very the first, believable, yeah.
Yeah, they've got a lot of specifics, which usually that's the way to catch out someone on a Two Truths One Lie, right? Is they won't be able to name, his name's CMO. A client at Microsoft.
Just say CMO, yeah.
Yeah, Stratford specifically for the mug in Revolut, Dublin. I work in fraud at Monzo, and I've encountered a lot of the. I mean, you didn't get defrauded, hopefully, but that exact stuff happens. Like people will swap out cards, and then they manage to get it back.
Yeah.
Although it could be a friend of his, something that's one of those could be a story of a friend.
I like the way he told the story about the mug in, so I want to believe it.
I saw a post on his Instagram, which was him flexing his. So I believe that.
You believe it.
You're on the close friends. Okay, okay,
okay. I think part of him wanted to go up on the dance floor and be like, yeah. That. I'm going to go burp as the line.
I was going to go burp as well, but I don't know. We should cover our bases here.
All right.
So I'm going to say, let's say the mugging one isn't real.
Mugging one isn't real.
I believe it, yeah.
Okay. I think the burp isn't real.
Correct.
Well, I was just spreading
any element of truth in there, or
in the burp?
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
Oh, right.
Standards to maintain,
right? But you went on the dance hall, the bingo dance hall.
Yeah, that was an epic night. That was honestly fantastic. Like, I've never had so much fun.
Because I thought you were about to point towards there's a bingo place in Shoreditch. It's called Hijingo. I'm not sure if you've heard of it.
The Dublin one is similar to that.
Yeah.
It's like, I think it's called like Bonkers Bingo or something.
Now, I'm addicted to this bingo place. I want a free holiday to Italy. I want so much stuff. And actually, we kind of talked about this before, is I feel like, especially in London, now that we're all living in London, working a full-time job, I work a job, I do studying, I do so much stuff. And the one thing, and I think you as well, doing your side hustles and everything, as long as your job and you start in quite an internet shop soon. How have you found, throughout your professional career in London, navigating, you know, maintaining a social life in a way that means you can meet up with your regular group of friends, new people, without having the flexibility to sort of cancel events if you want to? How has social stuff been in that situation in terms of working full time in London and everything?
It's hard, right? Like, I think, you know, people think of that Venn diagram of social life, sleep, and sort of success almost, like your work. I think you have to figure out what is it that you want from your life. And I don't just mean work. If you look at it exactly like that, I think it's the wrong path. I think, what do you want from life? What do you want to achieve? What do you want to do? And then how are you? I don't always necessarily agree in balance as well, but what are you doing that's helping you get there? So like for me, I'm a product leader at Google across all of EMEA. We're building a health and fitness app to help get people active across 90 countries at the moment. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at exploring a new idea within sort of performance marketing as well. Go to the gym, play hockey, have a really lucky to have really good social life. And then, you know, you do other bits and bobs, like your own personal time. It is very difficult to manage time, but you have to be ruthless about what you do, why you do it, and who are you doing it with. Mm. I think that's the first starting point.
Mm. Is this something you sort of developed over time, this kind of system? Or is it?
I grew up really fat and kind of obese as well. So I used to be really sort of socially insecure about myself and, you know, about my sort of position in school and different things.
Okay.
And just, I think developing fitness and healthy habits really helped me unlock maybe who I want to be and who I can be, even more importantly. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big reader, but the book that really changed my life and my thinking was Atomic Habits.
By
James Clear. It just set out processes or ways in which you can achieve what you want.
Yeah.
And I think it really clarified for me, like, if you want, anything is achievable if you set your mind to it, mm-hmm. mindset, process, consistency, intensity, repetition, learning. It's not rocket science almost in a way.
I think I agree. The importance of like processing that, I think, is really underrated, at least underestimated. Mm-hmm. I think I read Atomic Habits as well. It was the one thing that stood out to me in that entire book. Just having something that you do basically every day, or something that you do every week, something that you can do consistently, repetitively, something that you can, that's small, manageable. Like you said, it's not rocket science at all. It really is just small, manageable chunks. And then, have you seen that thing about if you improve 1% a day?
Yes.
In a year, you'll be...
Do they talk about that in Atomic Habits?
It's essentially the same concept. It's just small, manageable chunks. And I think you're right. You don't need to have like some big revelation.
Mm.
You just need to be able to
do the same thing.
Exactly. Yeah, it's consistency, small things again. Right? Mm-hmm. It's like for me, exercise and fitness is that. It's my daily like discipline.
Exactly.
I get so much positive, you know, endorphins out of it, mm-hmm. but it's just that consistency that if you do something every single day and you may try and get better week by week, month by month, you will see progress and you'll see improvement.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like the antithesis of the whole get rich quick thing. It's
exactly.
like you don't need to get rich quick. You'll still be rich in 20 years.
So in habits and fitness and everything, is there a personal sort of story there that led to, because you founded or co-founded Magic Mountain, right?
Mm-hmm. So on that front, like, I don't know. I mean, I've always said, like, engage the people around you, focus on impact, and drive value. Mm-hmm. So when I was a student at York and I started, relaunched, revamped York Community Consulting, the problem we were trying to solve was to help students get real-world employability opportunities without needing work experience to get work experience. That's sort of cyclical loop. Mm-hmm. When we were building that, I met somebody who will remain anonymous as part of the mystery, who was one of my, you know, a friend, a mentor, a leader, a partner at a Big Four consultancy. And I was like 17 and he was, you know, he was a York grad. He was like in his, I think, early mid-30s, and he had killed it. Like, he had done so well in his life, but still so down to earth. He took me under his wing and he gave me work experience. And the first time I met him in his office in London, he was like, you need to redo that tie. It's a classic private school, public school, fat tie. Like, you need to redo it. And he made me redo the tie in his office. Right? I thought, this is brilliant. Like, he just gets it. And so, and if we go back to what I said at the start, like, focus on impact. Like, YCC, York Community Consulting, was a great success at helping students get jobs. And I think he recognized that. I think he saw the stuff that we could build, like, from an entrepreneurial standpoint. Engaging with others, me engaging with him and being persistent enough to say, how can I also help you as much as you're helping me? He founded Magic Mountain in sort of early 2020.
Okay.
And he basically brought me on as, you know, employee number one, employee number three, whatever, within the first month. And then it just, you know, we developed our first product, our first go-to-market strategy. And it all came from engaging with people around you and like investing in those relationships. And, you know, we have just grown since then, like as part of a founding team. You know, we're live in lots of different countries now. We're working really cool corporates, really cool gyms and things. So it's been a cool journey in that sense.
Nice. Yeah. So Magic Mountain specifically, is it a fitness app? What does it focus on? Building habits, fitness habits?
Yeah, so for us, we're focused on building habits. So for example, let's say the three of us download the app. We create a challenge, right? In that challenge, we are going to log our activity, like log our movement. And it's different because all movement counts, whether it's walking, running, CrossFit, cycling, whatever you're interested in, it all counts. In the app, there's a leaderboard. And as you exercise, you kind of go up that leaderboard, right? Oh, yeah. Now, it's competitive because you want to be at the top of the leaderboard, but it's also inherently collaborative because you're all competing towards a common goal. Mm. And it's social because there's an inbuilt chat functionality, which you can share messages and videos and emojis and stuff. But ultimately, the idea is if you exercise, Zane, for example, I will get a nudge, a notification, and it'll induce me to exercise.
Oh, interesting.
And it reinforces that positive habit.
So it's adding the social network element into right.
Yeah, exactly. Element. Exactly.
Okay, exactly. Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
That's very interesting.
I think one thing I've definitely struggled with is building habits in terms of fitness and stuff. And maybe I sometimes think an expensive gym membership can solve that problem or something. But at the end of the day, it's just about building those habits and everything. Yeah. What's your sort of number one tip personally? What's been your fitness journey and how, if someone's just starting out or struggling to maintain a habit, what would be your advice to them?
Ask questions. Like, you know, I mean, I think best thing you can do is one, go to a space that is conducive to like you getting better as a fitness individual. Mm-hmm. Right. And that, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean like the high end gyms, but just being in a place where like, you know, people are like pushing themselves and you feel inspired. Like, I train at Gymbox and I feel so inspired by people that are like, they are athletes. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm there like trying my best. And I think being around people that are pushing themselves in a fitness capacity in a healthy way is so valuable, like so valuable.
Yeah, I think you can translate that anywhere in life, right? Just being around people who are like where you want to be. Mm-hmm. That's just so inspiring.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It's fundamentally what it is, isn't it? Is the people you surround yourself with without even realizing it, subconsciously influenced. Yeah. I think is that sort of what a bit of the aim with the Magic Mountain app is, that social network and creating that entire culture?
For us, it's just been about, we just want to get people active because, you know, think about it, like in the world, we have a problem, right? Like we're living, we don't move enough. You know, as humans, like we were, I mean, like to think born to move, but how much do we actually move in a day? you know, and that's what the app is trying to do, is trying to help people induce that habit, whether it's through a challenge where you see the net, you see the notifications, you see other people working out in a collaborative environment, as a habit tracker as well, to say, okay, if your goal is, let's say, I want to sleep 7 days a week, mm-hmm. you know, as we talked about in the James Clear bit, like you have to go in that app and you have to click that box and say, yeah, I slept 7 hours last night and 7 hours today. And, you know, it should be 8 hours, yeah. you know, but every single night, right? So it is that we're just trying to help people get active. And it's been a hit with, you know, F45 groups, with different CrossFit communities across the world, different corporates around at the moment as well. But it's just centered on, we just want to get people active, no matter what it is.
No, that's it's a great message and a great journey, I think. Going into the actual sort of mechanics of running a startup, how was that whole, journey, I suppose? How was the first month? How's it translated? How's it, like, changed since you've implemented the market strategy, since you've got customers and everything? Just give us a little idea about how that went.
Yeah. it's a roller coaster, right? Like, you know, I mean, we all started, like, there was, I think, you know, four of us that started this journey together in 20, uh-huh. like, kind of early, you know, when COVID really hit around then, actually.
Oh, was it in the pandemic that you started?
Yeah, pandemic, mm-hmm. May 2020, right. We all kind of started this journey.
That's an interesting time to start a fitness app, too.
Wow. Yeah, like, and it just, you know, we had a really cool, like, called a core team with different skill sets across product, tech, consulting, finance, you know, it was a superstar dream team. We were working with some cool agency partners as well. We did obviously fundraising, etc. Uh-huh. But we were all, like, at the time working, you know, we were working full time as well. Like, we didn't start this with a vision to say we want to build a fitness app. It just said, oh, there's something here which we can help people with. Uh-huh. Let's see what it turns out to be. So, you know, there were highs, like, you know, you get your first customer, you sign your first, like, gym or your first client. Mm-hmm. There's loads of, the product's not working, there's a bug here. And especially, remember, like, in most apps, and I've seen this across my corporate experience as well, from Instagram and especially at Google as well, when people, like, engage with technology, they expect the best thing, mm-hmm. right? You know, mm-hmm. we get annoyed when Facebook goes down or Instagram goes down or WhatsApp goes down. So when you are experiencing a new app, you're like, if it's not the best, why is it not the best?
Yeah. You know what I mean? There's a standard set in terms of, it's so easy. Any app you want, you're going to find the best technology. You're going to find one app that doesn't let you down.
Yeah.
It's really easy to switch over. That's an interesting point. I think that's especially true now than it used to be about 5 years ago, when you'd be familiar with YouTube buffering, right?
Yeah.
And now when there's the increased, have you noticed the increased adverts? Like, there's like three adverts per video now. Yeah. And I'm thinking, I just can't stand this.
You should sign up for the premium
subscription. I do. So I had the YouTube premium subscription as a student, right? So it's subsidized. Yeah, now I've graduated.
Yes.
And I was like, you know, I'm saying a London life, cost of living crisis. And I'm like, let me reevaluate my stuff.
Tough.
And I don't think I need YouTube premium. So I cancel YouTube premium. And now I think I really want to.
I have the exact same thing. I cancel for 1 month and the ads are infuriating.
Yeah.
Like, actually, it's hard to go back.
I mean, look, I also work in the industry, so I don't really mind the ads.
Helps you out. I think one thing related to moving around, you mentioned, how have you found commuting in London during your professional life? And how are, you know, people newly entering the London professional life going to find it?
Yeah, I mean, so commuting is an interesting topic in London, because I've kind of lived a bit everywhere, like St. John's Wood, Hampstead Garden Suburbs, like Bushey Heath, like High Holborn, like a bit, you know, and so I've tasted all forms of commuting, from like a 20-minute walk to like hour door-to-door. I think commuting it's a challenge in this city. Mm-hmm. I really am astonished sometimes that pre-COVID we were going into work 5 days a week, like doing that
rush hour,
right? You know, kind of freaks me out. Like, we just became these robots, just constantly, you know, you wake up, go early, stay late, and just repeat 5 days straight and burn out over the weekend and start again.
Right.
I think one of the positive benefits of COVID, the pandemic, has been the more flexible work situation we're in now, where you only have to go in 2 days a week, 3 days a week, because you get so much time back. Mm-hmm. You're not commuting, almost, like, just to, you know, spend time with your family, like, go to the gym, do other bits and bobs. Yeah. So commuting is a challenge. Like, I think, you know, the city is taking good steps, but I appreciate there's like different strikes going on and different things. So it's tough. Like, it's tough.
It's interesting though, because, you know, you mentioned what it used to be pre-COVID was you'd go in 5 days a week, and I felt like it was an autopilot thing. You wouldn't even notice commuting. And that break you have now of 2 days in between, when you get on the tube, you realize it. You're completely conscious, right? And I was talking to someone, they were a psychologist, and they were talking about this paper that was talking about irreversible mental health damage the tube does. Sort of, I mean, day in, day out, Like, it really does get to you. Yeah. And so one trend I've been seeing, and I've been trying out for a while, is e-bikes. You know, the Lime.
Yes, yeah, I use them. Have
you used them? How'd you find it? How'd you find that experience?
So I love e-bikes, but I recently found out, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but the Lime bikes are actually capped at a speed limit of 8 miles per hour.
Yeah.
Which I find really annoying. Like, not to say I'm a road race faster, speed racer, but like, I mean, I don't know. I grew up in Holland, so I'm used to cycling a lot, you know, and there were times where like I'd be looking at my watch and hitting like, you know, 20, like 30 kilometers an hour and just go blitzing it down. Mm-hmm. But now I find it really struggling to have the e-bikes. You know what I have found quite interesting on a commuting side is the riverboats in the summer.
Oh, the Uber boats.
Yeah, Uber boats.
Yeah, they're like, pretty sweet.
They're like, pretty sweet, actually.
I mean, the seats are comfortable as hell. It's a whole... you've been on the Uber boats. Oh, man, I remember sitting there and I was like, this is comfier than a first-class flight. Like, they are proper... And then they've got like a little, you know, cafe bar area and everything. And just the entire experience of you're going under the Tower Bridge.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Interesting. Yeah.
And that's what I was saying. I personally think the Uber boats are probably going to have to reduce the prices anytime sooner, especially with the amount of people moving to West London.
Yeah.
I see it genuinely becoming like...
It's like an experience, right?
It's an experience in your daily commute. That's
like, it makes commuting an experience, which is an interesting like shift. Because obviously, like you were saying before, 5 days a week.
Yeah,
it would have just been autopilot. I think maybe because you were working 5 days a week, you had no time to deep the situation.
Oof,
that's right. And just it's an everyday you're surrounded by water and everything, which definitely has. Like, I mean, it's not great water, the River Thames.
Is it not really low? Right
I mean, it's I mean, it's not very blue.
Solution of London.
But hey, it's. I think it's better than the underground.
I will take it. I'll take a positive attitude. You know, we'll take it. We'll take it.
But I think it's definitely changing the landscape in terms of how many people I've seen in terms of e-bikes and everything.
Yeah, and you're already saying the traffic levels have decreased, right?
Traffic. So he's just moved to London, and there was some traffic today,
so
right?
So for me, I've been like, I live in like Dalston, so I've been looking around, and I just think this place is crazy. I was in the King's
Park. I was like, there's not much traffic today,
and he was like, yeah, it's not like busy.
It's actually not busy today at all.
No,
mate, I look outside, I'm like, what is going on?
Not good news for you, I guess.
No, London is a super big. Obviously, you guys grown up in like big cities. Like busy cities, at least. The shift between like a small town and London is insane. I can't even describe.
I think that's why it's even more important, or at least I found it, to have little bits of activities that incorporate fitness as well. I've started going to these dance classes.
Yes,
doing the best thing ever, right?
Yeah.
I've seen your dance videos. How was it? When did you sort of go to classes and everything?
I've always enjoyed Bollywood dancing from the Pakistani side, like going to weddings, and I've always wanted to dance. Never had the confidence to dance, and then I think a few years ago I just started it, and like I think you just have to start and push yourself out. And I was like, I love this. Like, you know, I had like red shoes on for different dances, and then my cousin got married in. There were three big weddings in between the space of like 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want to up my game, you know, really want to max out and make sure she has a really fun and a fun time. And that's when I started taking, a lot of it was self-taught over YouTube. Like you just watch stuff.
Oh, nice.
Like, you know, you just try things.
Yeah.
And then I finally enlisted a teacher for my solo performance in February. my cousin's got a year.
Oh, wow. How was that experience? Between that and a TED Talk, which one was more frightening to do?
The darts was
what do you think you said you enjoy it quite a lot. Have you tried other forms of dance, or is it something specific about Bollywood dance that you find
so I speak Urdu, the native tongue for Pakistan. Like I can speak it, but I don't always like understand the more kind of poetic romantic side of the language. But I think with the music, I just enjoy the beat, and like it's actually a lot of my gym music because the beat is very good and you don't get distracted, because I don't really understand all the words. I understand most of it but not all of it, so you can really focus on what you're doing. And I think with the thing with dancing is just I have done slow dancing, I have done a little bit of what is it like they do in South America and Salsa dancing.
Salsa.
That would have been a hit at the wedding.
I did salsa dancing. But Bollywood dancing, there's just so much like color and energy and fun to it. Like,
I suppose there is the whole, like, it's our culture aspect as well, right?
I think there's two parts to it, because at the classes I go to, there's a lot of people who don't come from a South Asian community, and you can tell they're loving it as much as we are. And I tried like going to hip-hop dances, and they're like, they're cool. But I think what it is with Bollywood is there's one element, which is it's our cultural identity, and subconsciously we feel like we're, you know.
It's an interesting way to express it, right?
Yeah.
Like you're saying about if you don't understand language, but you can still express it.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Right? Exactly.
For sure.
Yes.
And it's just every culture has something which they have pride in. And I think dance, for sure, mm-hmm. within the South Asian community, everyone's seen Bollywood dancing. And what got me hooked was seeing Quick Style. Have you seen the Quick Style video?
Yeah.
The Quick Style video. It is. You've not seen the Quick Style video?
Like Norway or something.
I don't know.
The one in, like, was it Norway?
Yeah, the Norwegian group. Yeah, so the Norwegian group, they've choreographed. I saw that video and I was like, wow. Let's give it a shot and see how it goes. But particularly with Bollywood dancing, there's an element of acting involved. There's an element of performance. And I was speaking to my therapist once about this. So I worked briefly as an actor and I still do audition tapes and stuff from time to time.
Wow.
And my therapist actually, when she found that out, she mentioned to me, so I've got ADHD, and she said, that's such an important part to be doing in terms of regulating your emotions, right? It's an opportunity for you to just have an hour or two or something to just sort of incorporate, you know, tune into different emotions. And I found, at least with dance classes, particularly with Bollywood dance classes, for anyone going, it's the opportunity to do that same thing. It's performative. It's, you know, if you understand the language to a bit as well, you understand what they're talking about.
And
that's what it is. I think it's taken an hour or half an hour away from your busy life and sort of doing a bit of performance, not to anyone else, just within itself. And
it's almost reflective, right?
Yeah. Reflective, yeah. It depends on the song.
I think you feel very in touch with the music and what's going on. Like, my solo performance at the wedding was... I mean, it was a solo performance and everything, but I just enjoyed it, like, fully enjoyed it. And even, like, in the classes that, you know, I've seen you going to, people really are in the zone. Like, they're really feeling what's going on. And you can just tell they absolutely love being present in the moment for that.
Presence. That's exactly what it is. That's the one thing I found out of all things, which is difficult to do in London. You have no choice but to be present when you're doing that sort of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Performances, you know, I think that's an interesting discussion. And you previously mentioned things about your journey with being insecure when you're growing up and everything. Mm. How has that affected your confidence growing up, and how is confidence something you've been able to transform over time to apply in situations such as large public speaking events or performances and stuff like that?
Yeah. So I think for me, like, I think growing up sort of, like, I've always had a really happy childhood, right? Mm-hmm. I can't complain, very, like, privileged, you know, everything I ever wanted to have. Uh-huh. It set a lot of good values in me from there. But I don't know, I think just, you know, going to school and, like, being the fat kid, or, like, having, let's put it this way, like, a slightly larger chest at a certain age, like, basically, than a lot of other people, you just feel insecure about different things. Like, you know, I'd be like, you know, for example, I remember, you know, be like running and I'd be like jiggling everywhere, right? basically. And it's like insecure, and you get like name call and everything. So it did, like, obviously affect me in that sense. But I think for me, it just said, I used to get bullied for it as well, which wasn't great, right? But I think for me, like, I think a lot of credit to my parents on this. I just said to myself, if I ever get to a position where I have an ability to influence and affect and help people, I'm not going to use it like this. I'm not going to bully. Right. I'm not going to cause harm. I'm not going to make fun. I'm going to try and make an active decision to try and make things better.
Wow, yeah.
Because I said, like, you know, bullies, I was like, you guys just have this false sense of power on a playground now we think about it. But it really affects me on that sense. And that's why public speaking became such a useful avenue for me, because when you speak, it is a privilege to, one, have the platform to speak, but also for somebody to listen to you. And what you say, the way you communicate, what you communicate, has power. It has influence. Mm. And we should be wanting to use that for good, and not just saying speeches for the sake of it, but actual meaning in what we're saying. And I think I always said, if I ever got to that position, I want to create change, positive change, and not be a bully.
Yeah, you express the same sentiment. But you can see it with the Magic Mountain, you can see it with public speaking, so I think you've lived up to that.
It's using a platform that way.
It hasn't always been pretty, like, my public speaking journey. Like, I will say, like, to your point about feeling insecure and feeling fat, like, I did my first sort of talk when I was in year 10, and one of my teachers, he took me, it was my school here, Aldenham School up in Elstree.
Okay.
One of my teachers, he took me to our sort of, like, chapel, you know, where we used to have all the assemblies. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I delivered a speech in front of maybe 500 people. You know, you're in year 10, I don't know how old you are, but I was wearing a blazer and I was sweating. Yeah. Like, I was profusely sweating and nerve wracking, and the like thing was shaking.
Legs shaking, everything.
I was like, how do I get out of here? But you know, then he just taught me so much of like, you know, plant your feet, look down, then look up, breathe. Mm-hmm. And like, you control what you say.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't use breathe, all these different things, which, you know, you will have come across acting, but it just helped. Gave me so much confidence.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned, like, anything I did related to acting stemmed more so from my public speaking journey than anything else. Yeah. So everything, I think a lot of the things I did stemmed from wanting to do public speaking. It was probably the worst thing ever about me. You know, I was terrible. I couldn't even speak to anyone, my own parents, the teacher or anything. And it was just stepping out my comfort zone. I think more than it was about public speaking, it was an opportunity. It was like, this is something I'm really bad at. I want to try and see how much I can improve in this. And it became, honestly, my biggest skill. I mean, I spoke at the House of Lords this year, and I remember there was this moment where I stood there talking about my journey. Yeah. And I was like, you know, so far I've had the opportunity to speak here at the House of Lords, the UN in New York and South Korean Parliament. And I just stood there for a moment to take that in. Yeah. And
that's very special, by the way. Like, that's quite an accomplishment in itself.
And that was the entire moment when it kind of hit me, this entire journey.
Mm.
I think it depends how you get into public speaking as well, but you're completely right. The breathing point, one thing that I learned that really, really kind of changed the way with any sort of, not even just public speaking, being in a meeting, doing a presentation. I just took a second there right now. For me, it felt like the longest time in the world. For you, it felt like nothing. And it's just developing that habit of learning to understand how a second for you feels much longer than it appears to another person.
Do you also feel that when you're dancing as well?
No, I suck at dancing. I'm not very good. Dancing is the one thing that I'm... No, but to be honest, dancing, the same thing in terms of... It was an opportunity. It was like, I know I have no sort of skills in this whatsoever, which means I can only get better. That's what it means, right?
That's a really good point. Taking a point of like insecurity, taking a point of weakness and making it your own is very powerful. And it's like what you've both done, I think.
Definitely. And my sort of mentor, I think... I do want to talk about mentorship as well for a bit as well later on.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But my mentor, one of the things they taught me whenever I told her, you know, I want to step up my comfort zone. She said, you want to make your comfort zone bigger. That's what you want to get into the habit of doing. You can spend your entire life trying to step out of it, go back in, out of it, in and out. Why don't you just work on figuring out ways to make your comfort zone bigger? And I think that really had a, you know, mentality switch for me in terms of, this isn't something I'm trying to do temporarily. I'm just trying to expand the things I can do, the resilience I can build, my general mentality and motivation, and that's all transferable. It goes hand in hand.
For sure.
And I think you probably noticed doing that yourself in many ways as well.
Make your comfort zone bigger.
Yeah. Don't just step out of it, make it bigger.
That's good. That's very good, actually. Yeah.
I'm not taking credit. It's my
That's great, actually. Like, I've never really thought of it like that.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's important. Like, even in my professional career, I've always wanted a new challenge. You know, I've always wanted to work on cool things. And I mean, I feel very lucky, and I've really enjoyed my career path from Facebook to Microsoft to Google. Facebook, because I co-started our first ever UK venture capital startup program, working with early stage seed and Series A companies, helping them accelerate their growth, product market fit. And Microsoft as a client partner, managing a team, again, stepping out of your comfort zone, but also making comfort zone bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I actually sort of kind of manage a team a little bit at the age of like 24 is a challenge, right? Yeah, like you're very much out of your depth at managing people who have years of experience, but also time on you. And you have to respect that, but also work with that. Mm-hmm. So, and then again, coming into a company like Google, which is just huge, and it just moves so quick, and there's so many people and processes, again, out of your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
I will admit, I have been exhausted from work because, as you said, you're trying to make your comfort zone bigger to grow.
Mm.
And it's such a valuable point, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely, for sure. Mm.
I just want to talk a little bit about your just career in general. Obviously, we've just graduated. Mm-hmm. We're about to sort of go into this big world. And, you know, you've had, what is it, 4 or 5 years experience now?
I'll be 4 as of September 10th.
Wow. Yes. And you've already seen so much in the world of work. So he's been everywhere. I just want to know a little bit more about your maybe just journey, and like, how have you navigated these, like, all these crazy different switches? And, you know, how do you feel about your work now?
I love what I do. Yeah. I absolutely love what I do. Like, so I've always been in a sales and marketing sort of growth career.
Right.
We talked about what I did at Facebook, working with startups to help them, you know, grow basically through Facebook, Instagram, advertising effectively, and through that. I loved it. Absolutely enjoyed it. I also launched a, like a sort of a humans of kind of Facebook series to induce culture within the company, a video series. And then, you know, Microsoft was a bit more traditional role, working as a client partner, managing a team on the advertising side. Mm-hmm. And then Google, again, within our advertising organization. So I sort of sit as a product leader between our sales teams who work directly with customers like Amazon, Booking, mm-hmm. Expedia, okay. and like engineers. And my role is to make sure like the thing works, you know, like yeah. make sure we're driving commercial value. People can find stuff they're looking for. We're helping businesses. We're helping consumers. And I think for me, like careers is... It's a tough one. Like at the end of my, you know, I've never had it. People think I've had it easy. Like, oh, he's been everywhere. He's worked all these places and maybe, but do you know what? I was rejected like, I don't know, 40 plus times before I got my job at Facebook. Like, wow, think right. about it. At the end of second year, I had said no to JP Morgan, one of the world's largest investment banks. I said, yeah. it's not for me. Mm-hmm. It's not where I belong. I loved it. I appreciate people that work there, but it's not where I belong. I said, yeah. I'm going to do better. I realized I don't want to go down a consulting pathway because it just wasn't for me either. I said, okay, yeah. where can I go? You know, I'd done everything. Like I tried a PNG sort of scheme. I didn't make that. I was going to all these final interviews. You're traveling up and down the country yeah. from York, failing. I even had a moment in December sort of 2017, where I got my rejection from PNG after like a 6-stage long process. Oh, wow. I just cried, you know.
Wow.
You're just like, come on, I've done yeah. a talk, I like lead teams and sport and everything, and yeah. I just can't get anywhere.
What more can I do?
Yeah, you're like, what more can I do? And you're just there like regret. I was like, oh, I had this job and I turned it down and I didn't go back. And I was like, why? And I think, like, especially for young grads, the thing I learned there was resilience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, that's the first thing. You need to really have resilience and take it as a learning. Like, I like to think if it doesn't happen, it's not for you.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Okay. Yeah. Right. I think the other thing for me that I learned as my career has progressed is always like you own your career. It's a jungle gym. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm very fortunate that I've always kind of moved up through promotions. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I've always kind of gone up. Even though I've changed companies, I've always gone up. And a lot of that has just come from, one, doing the actual work. I think is so important. Like, you need to do the work, right?
yeah. Do the work and do it well.
Do the work. Like, I think there's this, like, misconception sometimes that, you know, you could get... No, you have to do
yeah.
the work.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to actually work hard, mm-hmm.
yeah.
right? Engage with people. Focus on impact. And when I say focus on impact is, like, the three questions I like to ask, and this, again, came back from mentorship from my very first managers, was, what's the vision for success for yourself, for the company, for your team? Mm-hmm. What are the metrics for success? AKA, what makes you successful? What makes your manager successful? What makes the team successful? And what makes the business successful? Okay. Mm-hmm. And third, what are the biggest blockers? Uh-huh. What's the challenge? That's where you start. And then you work backwards. The same with a client. A client might say, our vision for success is to be the most profitable, let's say, credit card company the next year. Okay, great. What's right. the metric? Mm-hmm. We want to drive 120% increase in new customer acquisitions. Great. What's the biggest challenge? I don't know. Our ads aren't working or we can't measure it. That's where you start.
Right.
Focus on impact.
And the blockers.
So resilience, focus on impact. And the third thing is, like, you guys said, you know, you just graduated. Like, yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit older, fine. But I did shave today. but be a sponge. Like, uh-huh. you know, soak it in. I feel very gracious and very lucky to be surrounded by really incredible people. And like, my job is to soak it in. Like, soak in right. their knowledge. Soak in their, like, be that sponge and just wash the place. You know, do what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, we've got a lot of metaphors.
Sorry, a lot of that.
I think metaphors are a really important way to sort of visualize things. There's really so much you can learn in a textbook way, but then it's just thinking of it, which has visuals that really sticks with you for sure.
No, that is super interesting. I think that is, I mean, it feels like good advice for grads.
Yeah.
Just going into the world of work, just find out everything you can, I think is a good way to start.
It's tough.
The more you know, the more you can.
Yeah,
know,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly.
Which is super interesting.
It's about figuring out, I think what's more important is figuring out what you don't like more than it is what you like.
Very true. But yeah, and the more you know, the more you know what you don't like.
For sure.
Yeah. Very true.
In terms of how you approach things, was there ever a question of what will make me fulfilled? How much of that has played a decision in career? I know it's a big question, but what does fulfillment mean to you and how do you gain it from your current sort of job role, other things? How do you approach that aspect of life?
So this is... I think controversial.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I fully believe in the concept of happiness, rather fulfillment. And just bear with me, right? You feel happy when you feel fulfilled, when you're with people you like, you love, you enjoy being with. You're learning new things. You're feeling challenged. You're feeling empowered. You are working on things that you like. You're spending your time, whether it's at work or sports or whatever, doing things that you enjoy. You're feeling fulfilled. You're like learning new things. I think happiness is a consequence and a result of feeling fulfilled and wanting to be fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think one can go and say, I want to be happy. It's a good positive mindset, don't get me wrong. But we should go in saying, I want to be fulfilled. I want to wake up every day and do things that I actually care about. I want to wake up every day and be with people I actually care about. It's the same in relationships, right? Like, again, maybe a bit more controversial. But in relationships, I'm like, you know, people say, I feel so happy and I feel so in love and I love it. Like, it's fantastic.
This is a controversial statement. You don't believe it.
I don't want to be happy.
I don't believe in love.
To all the listeners out there. You know you are. I think, you know, in the sense of when you're with people that you love and you like, you feel fulfilled. Like, you feel complete. You feel a sense of comfort, but a sense of excitement.
Yeah,
that is fulfillment. That is happiness. And I think it's a mindset shift of, I want to go in being fulfilled to then be happy, as opposed to, I just want to be happy. Like, what is that?
No, that's a fair point. I think we equate happiness with like kind of like a sense of elation or something, right? Or like ecstasy or something.
Well, there's strands of happiness, isn't there? There's pleasure, there's contentment, and all of them relate to different sort of chemical stuff in your brain, dopamine and endorphins and everything. Mm. So I think I definitely agree in terms of fulfillment is, is what we strive for.
Yeah.
As a form of happiness.
And that's not necessarily a constant high.
No, for sure.
A sense of completeness.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think if you set the bar to say, I want to be happy, or you should always be happy, or like, why aren't you happy? You almost actually then, you make somebody or that person becomes pressure to say, oh, I'm not happy. Like, I should be happy. Right. And, you know, if we think of the whole like mental health debate where, you know, we're trying to get people to be more in touch with their emotions and provide that safe space and comfort.
Yeah.
If you're not feeling happy or like electric 100%, you kind of get into that, and I've been there, like in this loop of, oh, I should be happy, I should be really grateful, but it might just be you're not just doing stuff that you enjoy or that you're feeling fulfilled, basically.
Yeah, no, and it comes back to that thing you were saying about resilience as well. Like, if your goal is to be happy, then one, you know, extraneous setback will instantly put you into that spiral. So yeah, exactly. That's a very, very good point.
I think it's important to also admit that you won't always be happy. And that's completely fine. And when I was about 12 years old and I was, you know, deeply thinking about the entire happiness thing and stuff, a metaphor I like to kind of use that explains how I view happiness, I think similarly to you, is, you know, like a heart rate monitor.
Mm.
Goes up and down, right? What does it mean when it's going up and down? You're alive. The person's alive. If it's shooting all the way straight up, it's not a good sign. If it's going all the way down, it's not a good sign. If it's flat, it's not a good sign. And I think that that part of me, to me, happiness means liveliness. Right, to an extent. And that maybe links into fulfillment.
I love that.
It's fulfillment, but also combined with accepting that sometimes things aren't going to go to plan, being resilient, reflecting upon it, being in tune with your emotions, and knowing that for sure, being down is actually part of life. It's a part 100%. Of it being lively, and it's going to get back up. So, you know, I actually kind of agree. I don't don't believe in happiness in terms of the way it's put forward to us in the media and many other things and how it's sold to us. I think it's sold as in a book. Happiness, the idea of happiness is sold to us more than it is, more than we understand it and we experience it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a commercial happiness, the one that that we're talking about before.
Maybe that's what we're perpetuating over in the advertising industry. Right? Just that comment.
Where do you start seeing that TikTok, right?
Yeah, so actually
definitely not Google or YouTube for that.
Tomorrow I'm starting for TikTok in like a sort of ads kind of
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. And it's like this kind of idea about you know, how you're sort of selling things or what you're selling has recently been on my mind. Obviously, I don't want my employees to listen to this. I think more and more recently, I know you were talking earlier about the big tech landscape. I think a lot of big tech has been sort of geared towards this idea of selling something or like driving clicks. And for me, it's just been a thing to think about recently. Obviously, there's the way you approach like Magic Mountain is like started off as like a very positive thing, and it is still a positive thing. What do you think? I think generally about how Google, Facebook, all of Meta's companies, TikTok, everything has slowly sort of been geared towards this idea of
driving clicks and driving engagement rather than having maybe a social good.
Yeah, very interesting. So I think this will help maybe sort of articulate what I'm about to say. Like, I accepted my offer to join Facebook a month after Cambridge Analytica.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that excited me because I was like, there's a problem here.
Hmm.
There's a big problem here in terms of company governance, social governance, how data is used, and how we are serving clients and people, most of all people, to feel connected to each other. And, you know, do they feel they can trust the places they're working? But that excited me, and that's why I joined, you know, Facebook, or now Meta, when I did after that.
Mm-hmm.
I think companies like why have I always enjoyed working in the tech space as well is if you think about it, like, advertising is a medium of sort of distribution. Every business that advertises is trying to make a revenue or a profit or sell their goods and services to customers. And the way they do that is they connect through ads, whether it's on TikTok or Instagram or YouTube or on search. It's the same principle. Ads for them is, it's a click, but ultimately it's a sale. It's a conversion. It's a lead. It's a download. And that's a customer. That is a customer that has connected with a brand through what they have seen from the ad itself to what they've heard from their friends to then ultimately work with that brand, right? Like, and these platforms, we have to remember, one is, if we think of sort of the internet in itself, like, all the startups or the unicorns, like the Monzos of Revolut, they have grown on these platforms, and it's phenomenal.
That's true.
In terms of, I think, what they're doing for corporate, you know, corporate and social governance, there are elements which, you know, I'm very proud, you know, to be there, but it's not always perfect. I mean, you know, for example, like, at Google, our Mountain View Bay Area campus, the whole roof, or the majority of the roof, is now using solar panels. And it looks, have you guys seen Game of Thrones?
Yeah. I've not seen it, no.
So it looks like, I think it looks like a dragon, like, where it's just scaled. So the solar panels are going in, out, like almost like a mini mountain range to increase the capture of solar energy, right? So that we can facilitate more renewable energy powering the campus. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing a lot of these companies make these strides, and we need companies to make these strides. So we're all on the same page here, especially around climate change, to make sure that we all go in the same direction of using more renewable energy, trying to produce more renewable energy. And I think each of us, every employee that works at these companies that doesn't feel, oh, my company is not making enough effort, you are also accountable. You should be engaging with the leadership team, with the HR team, with any group possible to say, here's an idea, here's how we can make it more environmentally friendly.
Okay.
Example of that, I had a colleague at Facebook in 2019. I say these years like I'm so old now, it's only 2022, right? She had a great idea. She said, actually, at Facebook, you could go to a micro kitchen, open the fridge, and get a bottle of water.
Okay.
Think how much plastic you must use in a day. So much plastic. She said, why don't we just give everybody a water bottle and they can refill it? Think how much plastic that would have saved. That started in our Dublin office and it got rolled out across EMEA, the world, and so on. That is a fantastic idea. That is how an individual can work with the company, with the environment, and to make a change and make a difference.
Yeah, I like that idea of sort of how one individual effort can translate into a bigger change. How would you answer to sort of think, I'm not putting you on the spot, I know you're not,
like,
but it's something I've been thinking about as well. It's like, how do we sort of confront the idea that these things might be a bit performative or look a bit performative? Like, a solar panel roof is very cool. It's a stride. Is it a big enough stride? With the power that big tech has now, are we doing enough? What do you think about that?
I think always the answer to are we doing enough is no, to be honest. Always, I think there's always more things we could be doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I also say, like, no industry is perfect, right? I mean, you know, we compare, like, and I've really learned this on the journey, you know, and I've tried to keep a very open mind about these things. Like, the internet space is maybe what, 20 plus years old, and we're comparing against industries like law and finance, which are significantly older. You know, we're talking hundreds of years, if not more. The rate of technological development will always exceed the rate of knowledge accumulation,
right?
Because technology will change faster than before we can understand how it's used. I mean, you think of traffic lights, right? Like, it's funny, I came across this clip on YouTube. Traffic lights were actually installed to control speed. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. People were initially afraid of traffic lights. They were like, why do I need to stop my car? I should just keep driving. But it's a safety measure.
Mm-hmm.
So I always think these companies can be doing more. And, like, we're seeing that, you know, our leaders are being questioned and challenged at things like COP26, for example, different environmental forums and social forums. And I do think that we are all taking the right steps. Is it as fast as we would be like? No. But we're still making progress. I think it's always important to realize we are making progress and we can always do more, but we have to work together.
Yeah.
I think that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. We always learn from each other. And like each of us, for instance, I think about myself, like, you know, for the last year, I've tried to, you know, use more plant-based foods. I was heavily influenced by somebody I was I used to work with. And, you know, I started to then learn, oh, plant-based foods lessen greenhouse gas emissions. They're more environmentally friendly. Mm-hmm. But those are individual steps. And then if I can affect somebody else and, you know, try and incorporate more of that, I can I can reduce my greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. You touched on it earlier from like the e-bikes, things like that.
Yeah.
What can we each of us be doing as an individual that then layers up into society or an organization or a company and then make that change? So there's always more and more that we can be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's about recognizing your individual moral responsibility, but then also how it all accumulates. Yeah. To
and people having an agency place, and people doing things.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of this. Having the sort of maybe the, I guess the bravery or just having the, the courage.
I think like, is it like performative? Maybe to a degree, like, you know, I think if I like to think if a company's performative, I'm like, so am I then. Like I'm an individual worker at a company, like all the stuff that I post, I'm like, yeah, like maybe 20% of it is like negative or something, but 80% is positive. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm trying to induce change and inspire and things, but I think we're all challenged by that.
And I think one thing I would say that performative isn't necessarily bad. If I'm performatively like installing solar panels, I'm still installing solar panels.
Yeah, right? Still solar panels.
The solar panels are still.
Yeah, they still do. You know? I think that's something. And big tech is, like you're saying, it's not static. I think the rate of technological advancement recently has been insane, and we're seeing new frontiers. You said, like, this tech landscape is only 20 years old. Web 2.0. Now, what we're seeing, or at least what people hope we'll be seeing soon, is Web 3. And I think that grew, or that blew up in popularity over the past 3 years, mainly with the advent of cryptocurrencies. And then last year, we had NFTs, which I assume you're quite interested in. do you want to tell us a little bit about how you've sort of came across it, like, and how you're involved in NFTs, and just how you think the landscape's evolving? And
a lot of credit goes to my current flatmate, who think is a crypto wizard. And we sort of saw the concept of NFTs and just initially like, oh, people are making loads of money from this. And like, I think you get sparked by that and you start to dive deeper and like, okay, what is it? It's like this asset that you're buying. You know, think of like a normal sort of image. It's been collateralized, digitized, and that's in that form. NFTs then, I've bought and sold different ones with varying success. Like, I've made money, I've lost money.
Sure.
The most interesting one that I bought was an Adidas one. It was Adidas Into the Metaverse NFT.
Was it produced by Adidas?
It was produced by Adidas.
Yeah.
Adidas, sorry. There's only 20,000 of them that were produced for the entire world. Or they're phase one, now they're in phase two. Why did I enjoy it? Because it had utility. And that sparked an idea. And I actually tried to launch an NFT marketplace earlier this year. And the idea was that an NFT, at the end of the day, it's not just a GIF. It's not just an image. You can add value to it the same way of an event ticket or a membership or a, you know, a gym subscription or a concert. You can add these things into a smart contract as part of that NFT, which gives it that unique value. And I was like, there should be brands and creators who can use this actually to their benefit to create community, because when you buy the NFT, you're part of the community. It's like owning a rare sort of piece of artwork, right? And that's what kind of just kickstarted my mind. And, you know, my flatmate and I, we became kind of co-founders. We tried to launch this business, this marketplace for brands and creators, had varying success, embarked on some challenges. The market crashed. You know, I think it's dipping, right? I think it will come back. It will mature somewhere. I don't know.
I think there is like with many new creators, there was like a hype phase. I think very recently I just saw there was it a Bored Ape?
Yeah, the Bored Ape was the big one.
I think it was either that or another one. It was bought for $300,000 and sold, for $300.
Crazy.
Dollars. So the crash is maybe at least two. But no, I think it definitely is an interesting new space. And one thing interesting that you mentioned there is how you can potentially have NFTs with maybe like real life utility. I think one criticism of Web3 so far has just been like, it's like crypto nerds buying NFTs off of the crypto nerds and then selling it back to the crypto nerds.
Yes.
That evolution into it having real life utility, I think, is where this idea of maturing could potentially come about. I've seen some very, very crazy concepts. Probably none that we could even mention on this podcast.
But you're seeing it mature, So for example, you know, like there's for the first time this year, you know, you think of like, think of processes in the Web2 world, which are maybe slightly broken, like, you know, buying and selling houses, right? You have to, it's a very complicated process. Like you might, if you want to sell your house, you have to go online, list it, take all the pictures, do all that documentation, find a middle person to sort of organize and facilitate the buying and selling, you get different checks on. It's a long, lengthy process and it adds more and more cost. The first time this year in the States, a house was sold via an NFT. Because you could add every single detail to the smart contract. The value remains basically like a USDC, so it's pegged to the dollar. So it's still real value in a cryptocurrency. But all of the different things of, you know, I will move up by X date is all in the smart contract. I forgot the name of the company, but I was like, this is phenomenal. Like, it's changing the way we do work. The same that, you know, for example, Zoopla was a very fantastic kind of marketplace in that sense. It just removed these barriers to entry.
And I think that's particularly what it is, right? It's what are the immovable industries and how are you moving them? I think that with Monzo, that was the main thing, which is banking is an immovable industry. How do we do something to even move on the slightest? It's utilize the newest and best form of technologies to do that. And I think especially with housing, that sounds quite interesting. I've not come across that before. And it makes so much sense in terms of the utility of smart contracts and NFTs in that manner.
People are saying it's like, it's commodifying, like you're saying, immovable. Things like contracts. It's something that, like you said, has been behind this wall of lawyers and surveyors, everything. I've never sold a house. That's a super interesting use case. And it's just interesting to see where it's gonna land.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just looking at the time now, and I think we're gonna bring it to a close. But before we bring it to a close, this is an idea I'm stealing from Stephen Bartlett's podcast, and I'm quite a big fan of his podcast now. And he does this thing at the end, which is a question from you that's going to go to the next guest. You don't know who the next guest is. Yeah. It's just one question, and that question we're going to ask them at the start of the podcast. Do you want a few seconds to ever think about one?
I think my question to the next guest is, if you could do anything in the world that would create positive change, what would it be and why?
That's a good question to start off with,
I like that.
I had one final, I think, thing, which, you know, around your, like, careers and different different thoughts, which I thought was interesting. And I think generally around life, like, I think especially when people look at, like, careers, life and everything, time is opportunity, time is value, time is scarce. And I've always said, if you want to do something, whether it's build a company, get a new job, you know, do a really cool project at your current work, or even, you know, go on a date and tell somebody you like them, do it. Because I think people, like, we waste too much time, you know, and it can range from, maybe I should wait for my next promotion talk, or maybe, they just messaged me, I'll message them like in 2 days and I'll play the game or whatever. Like, I'm like, just do it. Like, seriously, what are we waiting for to actually go out there, be who we want to be with the people we want to be, and actually live a fulfilled, happy life? Time is value. Time is opportunity. Time is scarce. Go seize it.
Are you waiting for someone's reply?
I feel like it's been a common theme.
You know you are.
Okay, it's been great to have you on, Hash. Honestly, I think it's amazing to do a podcast in person. And I'm glad to finally do an episode where we really deep dive into just talking about everything, you know, talking about your entire journey, what you've done, how you feel about what you've done, and just general thoughts and reflections. Any last words, Beep?
No, absolutely. It's been a great podcast. I think possibly the best first guest we could have had in an in-person podcast.
Perfect.
I think, it's been really interesting to hear about your journey. And, you know, we'll be watching your future career with great interest.
No, I'm privileged. Honestly, thank you so much for having me on. Really privileged to be here.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Goodbye. Bye-bye.